Well, dear students, we're ready to finish up our discussion of bonds with a discussion of the yield spreads. What are they? Well, hang on a minute. And then the yield curve and what the yield curve may be able to tell us about the future of our economy. And then we'll take a look at bond valuation. And it's actually a lot easier than stock valuation because, yes, bonds are boring. And then end with some bond investment strategies. So slide number 20, the yield spreads. The yield spreads are the differences in interest rates that exist among various sectors of the bond market. And in general, as you would expect, the shorter the maturity, the lower the rate. And the longer the maturity, the higher the rate. Now, why is that? It makes sense. We'll take a look at some hypotheses about this. But the longer you have your money out there, the more chances for things to go wrong, right? So you're going to expect a higher rate. And then, of course, the higher rating of the bond, the lower the interest rate because, you know, it's a better quality debt. And the same thing is true with you, with your credit score. The higher your credit score, the lower the interest you pay. The lower your credit score, the higher your interest you pay. And we started with treasuries because they generally carry the lowest rates because the United States government, yes. And then the muni bonds, state and local governments. And then corporate bonds because corporations, even though most of them don't go bankrupt, some do. Well, some municipalities have gone bankrupt too, but it's very, very rare. Okay? So here, as of October 28th, 2018, are the yield spreads on various types of bonds. And this is from Fidelity, which has a pretty darn good website for bonds. It's harder and harder to get good information about bonds for free, because most people who buy bonds are fairly well off and they have their own brokers. But you've done a few quotes. Well, if you go to Fidelity's websites, they give you quotes on thousands of bonds, but they want you to sign up as a customer, right? Okay. Anyway, so they give you this for free. And we see that interest rates have been going up. Interest rates have been going up over the last couple of years. The Federal Reserve Bank has started raising short-term interest rates. That's their ability. They control the short-term. But the long-term is controlled by the marketplace. And long-term rates have been going up, but not as fast or as great as percentage as the short-term. And so we're going to see that in a little bit. We're going to see that in a little bit. But this is a great resource here. Here's the URL. There's the website for you to do some of your work with, some of your finding the spreads. I asked you to do that in Chapter 9. So see what's going on here? Look. You can now buy 3-month and 6-month treasury bills that are paying over 2%. A couple of years ago, they were paying nothing. But the 5-year, the 10-year are paying around 3%, and the 30-year is only paying 3.3%. So you see that the long end of the curve has not gone up anywhere near as much as the short end of the curve. Very interesting. We'll discuss that in a bit here. Slide 22. Often investors will speak about the bond spreads as being tight or wide. A tight spread means the interest rates among the bonds they are evaluating are very close to one another. For example, say you get a treasury paying 4.8%. Now, they're not paying that now, but they have in the past. They will in the future. But your corporate bond is only paying 5.1%. The corporate bond is not paying you that much more than what the treasury is paying you. That's a tight spread. Whereas if the treasury were paying you 3.2%, and the corporate bond were paying you 8.2%, that's a very wide spread. And for many years, bond yield spreads were very tight. And then in 2008 and 2009, they widened to levels not seen since the Great Depression. Why? Because people were terrified. And they rushed, it's called a rush to quality, a flight to quality. They rushed to this quality of treasury bonds, which drove down the yields because the price goes up, the yield goes down. And then corporate bonds, they dumped, by selling, the price going down, the yields went up. And as we took a look at with Ford, how it just the prices went from 1,000 down to 650, 580. Oh. But now they're narrowed again. They're narrowed again significantly. So bond yields, and take a look at the previous slide. You'll see that they're fairly, but except for the higher paying corporate bonds, the junk bonds or so. They were fairly tight with treasuries, but since the interest rates started going up, people are a little worried about the economy. They are now paying a lot more, so those spreads have widened. But still, they're still fairly small. So this graph is trying to show you on slide 23 the effect of inflation on bond rates. And as you would expect, as inflation goes up, we would expect bond rates to go up. So the blue is the red is the inflation. The red is the inflation, and notice that the bond rates sort of go a little bit behind it. But notice it was very volatile in the 70s, the inflation rate. But then we see the inflation rate dropping precipitously in the early 80s. And that was Paul Volcker, whose job was to break the back of inflation. He caused a severe recession in 80 and 82. But he said, we're gonna break the back of inflation. And then we saw the bond rates falling and falling and falling. And then in 2008 and 9, inflation actually went negative. Deflation, it's called. Prices were falling, mostly wages and housing. Yeah. And so since then, we have seen inflation moderate at about 2% or so and bond rates fairly low, which is what we'd expect. Now we see interest rates starting to tick up. Inflation still fairly moderate, but the Federal Reserve Bank is trying to do its best to raise interest rates to keep inflation from rearing its ugly head and to keep from the economy from overheating. And that's their job, folks. They have a dual mandate. Their job is to keep inflation in check and at the same time do their best to create full employment, to make sure everybody who wants a job can find a job. And those two things are diametrically opposed. They're competing interests. Because if you juice the economy so much that everybody's got a job and wages are going up, but then you got inflation, but if you kill inflation to the point where there's very little economic growth, then you're going to put people out of work. So it's a difficult job. It's not the Federal Reserve job is not an easy job. I love it when people scream and holler at the Fed. I thought, yeah, you could do a better job. Hey. Slide 24, the yield curve. This is the graph that represents the relationship between a bond's maturity and its yield at a given point in time. We also use this to make comparison amongst types of bonds. And as we looked at the spreads, normally the yield curve is what we call upward sloping. Longer-term bonds have higher interest rates than shorter-term bonds. And that's the normal. That's what we expect. That's what's usually the case. But sometimes the yield curve is downward sloping. It's also called an inverted yield curve. And shorter-term bonds and treasury bills and notes have higher interest rates than longer-term bonds. That doesn't make any sense. Hang on a minute. Slide 25. Here is what we normally see, an upward sloping curve. The red line, of course, if you're listening to this, you can't see it. I apologize. But it starts at the lower end of the yield and at the lower end of the maturity and then up slopes upward. The blue is a downward sloping, an inverted curve. We do not see that often. It just doesn't make sense. Why would short-term rates be higher than long-term rates? Very good question. And when does it occur? Slide 26. Here is the yield curve as of October 28th, 2018, and that's the dark, whatever that is, green, blue. And look a year ago, and then this one's 1 month ago. A year ago, it was more pronounced. Shorter term interest rates were down about 1% or so, and longer term interest rates went up to about 3%. But what's happened is the Federal Reserve Bank has been ratcheting up short term rates to the point where we saw 6 month, 3 month, treasury bills paying over 2%, 2.3, 2.4%. But has the long-term gone, the long-term 30-year gone up that much? No, it's gone up from a little under 3% to a little more than 3%. So the long-term, the long part of the curve has not gone up as much. And there's a danger, and people are worried about this, that if the Federal Reserve continues to ratchet up short-term interest rates, we may have an inverted yield curve, where short-term interest rates are higher. Short-term interest rates are higher than longer-term interest rates. Why is that dangerous? Why are people worried about that? Well, slide 27. What are some of the theories why longer-term debt securities normally have higher interest rates than shorter-term debt securities? Well, there are three hypotheses, reasons, thoughts about why, and they all make sense. Expectations, the shape of the yield curve reflects investors' expectations of future interest rates. The maturity preference hypothesis, where it also called liquidity preference. Investors tend to prefer the liquidity of short-term securities and therefore require a premium to invest in long-term securities. Right, the shorter the money is out there, the less things can go wrong, less time for things to go wrong. And then the market segmentation hypothesis, that the market for debt is segmented on the basis of maturity. So there are supply and demand curves, you economics fans, within each segment, which determines the prevailing interest rate. Now, we remember that the short term is controlled by the Federal Reserve Board, so they have control over that, Federal Reserve Bank. Each of these theories makes sense. Each has some merit. But how do we account for the times when the yield curve is inverted? That doesn't make sense. It flies in the face of these hypotheses. What factors could cause an inverted yield curve to occur? And what can the yield curve tell us about the future of our economy? Well, dear students, slide 29. Since World War II, every time the yield curve has inverted, short-term rates were higher than long-term rates, the economy has eventually fallen into recession. Now, there was one exception in 1966 where it just touched zero. It didn't go negative. It slowed, and then the yield curve inverted, and then the economy started growing again. And then the weirdest one was 2006, 7, and then into 2008. In 2006 and 7, the yield curve inverted very slightly. It was looked like a little boomerang. It wasn't the normal inversion where they're much higher. The short-term rates are much higher. They were just a little bit higher, so it was just slightly inverted. But this was going on for 2 years, and people were jumping up and down and saying, "The bond world is telling us we're coming for a recession." The bond market had been predicting a recession for over 2 years, but the stock market, people investing in stocks, basically didn't believe them. They didn't think it was going to happen. I was one of them. I didn't think, it doesn't look like we're going into recession. Housing is gonna fall, that's for sure. But, oh yes, oh no, it's gonna be a lot worse than we ever thought it was. I was reading the value line when they were coming out, and they're saying, we think housing's gonna have a soft landing, and it doesn't look as bad. And then they kept saying, now it looks really bad. It's really bad. By that time, it was, too late. So it wasn't until the fall of 2008 that the officials charged with tracking the economy acknowledged, we're in a recession. And it took over 2 years, but the bond ghouls were finally proven right. Now, why do we call them bond ghouls? Well, it's a nickname that's meant half in jest, but there's some truth to it. What happens when we have a recession? Well, stocks get clobbered, and interest rates fall. The Federal Reserve Bank typically will lower short-term interest rates, and the demand for money at the long term is lessened, sometimes precipitously. And so what happens when interest rates fall? Right, bond prices go up. So that's why they're often called the bond ghouls, because they want a recession to happen because, oh, my bonds are going to do. No, they're most, no. It's a nickname. It's a bit of a joke. But no, the bond, yeah, heavy bond investors do well when interest rates fall, because you saw how the price of their bonds goes up when interest rates fall. It's inverse relationship. So that's why we call them the bond ghouls. And by the way, which market is more important, stock market or bond market? It's certainly a silly question, because they're both very important. But folks, the bond market is far more important than the stock market. Why? Because if you're a corporation, if you're a municipality, a state and local government, or the federal government, and you can't borrow money, you have a serious problem. Exactly. So you can raise money if you're a corporation in the stock market, but it's not something you normally want to do unless, things are really cool for you, because that dilutes your ownership. What corporations have been doing lately is buying back their shares and reducing the amount of equity out there, hence, these supply and demand fans that decreases the number of shares, and if the demand is the same, the supply is decreased, the price goes up. But if you're a corporation or a municipality or the federal government, and you can't borrow the money to get from point A to point B, you have serious problems. Oh, by the way, which one's bigger? Is the stock market bigger or the bond market? The bond market is bigger. Yes. In fact, it's a lot bigger. It's usually about twice as much as the stock market. Yeah. So the bonds are boring, but they're very important. So let's continue now. Oh, and where are we, right? We're getting there. We're getting there to the point where the yield curve may be inverted and we may be seeing a recession. Well, folks, it's been over 10 years now, no, about 10 years or so, 10, 11 years. And so we're due. We're due. Slide 30, bond pricing. Okay, let's take a look now, spend a little time on bond valuation. Bonds are normally priced according to the present value of their future cash flows. Does this sound familiar? Semi-annual interest payments and the repayment of principal. Although we have to look at other factors such as the creditworthiness of the issuer. If the issuer runs into trouble, make sure you take a look at those Poway and those Ford bond quotes. The price of their outstanding bonds will fall because investors will be afraid of default, and they'll start dumping the bonds, and of course the price will fall, their yield will skyrocket, and then you have to decide whether you want to jump in and buy them when everybody else is running away from them. So let's take a look at the formula on slide 31. The bond price is equal to the present value of the interest income plus the present value of the repayment. Hey, dear students, this is the discounted cash flow model. Indeed it is. Except we have been using annual payments with our model in chapter six when we did the discounted cash flow. We really should be using semi-annual compounding because bonds pay every 6 months. But hey, annual compounding is easier to compute and it'll give you almost the exact same answer. So big deal. Computations are easily done using the present value tables, and of course spreadsheets make life a lot easier. So let's take a look at an example here. This is a bond, and I looked this up on the October 28th, from the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation. Now, who's the Bank of New York? You've probably never heard of them, but they're the nation's oldest bank, and they do quite a bit of work with other banks. Do you remember the Troubled Asset Relief Program, where $800 billion was injected into the banking system? They're the ones that got the money from the feds and distributed to the other banks. They were started 200 and some odd years ago by a gentleman you might have heard of, Alexander Hamilton. So, yeah, they're a venerable corporation, a venerable bank. And this bond was paying 3%. That's the nominal, the coupon yield, due October 30th, 2028. So it's a 10-year bond, and I did that on purpose to try to get it on the year, because you'll see why in a minute. Price to yield, 4.033%. That's the current yield of 3.276%. It's rated A-, which is not what you expect from one of the nation's oldest bank, venerable. But anyway, it's A-. And so 4.33 is close to 4%. So we're going to use 4% because the tables are on the whole percentage. We're going to look at the price and estimate it, value it, by taking the present value of the interest income plus the present value of the repayment. So this is very similar to what we did with the stocks. We took the present value of the dividend income, and we added that to the present value of what we believe the stock was going to be worth at the end of 3, 4, 5 years. Well, bonds are far more reliable, right? We know this is a 3% bond, and barring default on the behalf of Bank of New York, which they've been around for over 200 years, we're going to get $30 every year for 10 years. Now, we could use the old table and do $30 in year one, $30 in year two, $30 in year three, but we're going to add a new table. We're going to add a new table in Chapter 10, a new present value table. And so make sure you print this out because you're going to need it for the calculations. This table here, the present value of a dollar stream of payments, allows us to do all those years in one calculation. Instead of doing the present value of year number one, present value of year number two, of the interest payment for year number three, interest payment for year number four, blah, 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 blah. We just go across the 4% and go down to 10 years and see that 8.111 is the present value multiplier for that stream of payments. So let's minimize this. So what we did is we took $30 and multiplied it times 8.111. And that's the present value of the stream of income. So if you do that, that's about $243.33. So we're going to get $30 a year for 10 years. That's $300. But remember, we have to discount that. That's the verb we use. I know it. It drives people crazy. But we have to discount that $300. And it turns out that $300 we're going to get over the next 10 years is worth $243.33. But then we know, again, barring default on the behalf of the Bank of New York, which ain't going to happen, we're going to get $1,000 in 10 years. So then we revert back to the old table that we used in Chapter 6. And here I'm going to move over. I'm not going to move over. It's not moving over. I'll move the whole thing over to students. Here's the old table that we used. This is the same table we used in Chapter 6, but it's going 1 year at a time. So we go across the 4% and go down to 10 years, and to 10 years, Frank. 0.676. And so what do we do with that? We multiply the $1,000 times 0.676, and if you do that, you get $676. So you add the present value of the stream of interest payments to the present value of that one-time repayment of the bond, and you get $919.33. So the quoted price on FINRA was $915.67, a little bit less than what we expect, but the bond is rated A-. Yeah, exactly. And then there's a bond calculator that I'm going to do a little presentation for. It's not there yet, but it will be. That's a spreadsheet that does all these calculations for us. And the bond calculator says it's really, they believe it's worth $916.31 for annual payments. But remember we said semi-annual make more sense? They give us a couple extra bucks, $918.26 for semi-annual payments. Why? Because, remember, we're getting that money, we're getting half, we're getting $15 twice a year, not $30 at the end of the year. So it's just a little bit more precise, but remember, it has to do with the marketplace and what people are willing to pay. But it turns out that our valuation techniques on bonds are going to be very, very close to what the prices are. Why? Because most all bonds pay what they say they're going to do, and then pay the interest they're going to pay, and then pay back the principal. So yes, dear students, even when it comes to valuation, bonds are boring. But remember, boring is good. Remember, we're getting paid every 6 months instead of waiting until the end of the year, so that's why the semi-annual payments are a little bit more. But the reason the price is down a little bit, I think, has to do with the fact that it's rated A minus. But the Bank of New York is going to make its payments, folks. It's not going to go belly up, I hope. I mean, you don't really know what's going to happen in the next 10 years, but they've been around for over 230 years or so. So now these are the calculations you're going to do in Chapter 10. And it turns out that, again, once you do them a couple of times, you might not understand what you're doing at first, but once you do them a couple of times, it's pretty straightforward. So there's a worksheet. Actually, there's three worksheets. And then there's the assignments, which is very much like the worksheet. And then the exam is going to be very much like the worksheet and the assignments. Okay. 33, reinvestment risk. Now, what is this? Okay, so we have a few more slides to run through and discuss some things that most of us will never have to worry about because we buy bond mutual funds. It's the mutual fund manager that's going to do the trick because, as we saw in Chapter 9, they want a $25,000 minimum, and they want very wealthy people, and most of us working grunts are just going to buy bond mutual funds. But let's take a look at reinvestment risk. The uncertainty about a future value of an investor's bond investments that results from the need to reinvest bond interest payments and redemptions at yields not known in advance. Huh? Look, you as a bond investor are continually getting your interest payments and getting your principal payments. And interest rates are changing all the time. So you don't know what's going to happen with those interest payments and those principal payments. Now, if you're using them for income, if you're living off of them, you don't care. But if you're reinvesting them, the changing interest rates represent some kind of risk. Let's read together. Changing interest rates don't only affect the price of your bonds. They also affect your future income as you need to reinvest the interest income and the bond repayments. If interest rates have fallen, sure, your bond prices have gone up, but your income level will fall as you reinvest your income and bond repayments. Likewise, if interest rates have risen, your income level will rise. And this is why when people start freaking out about interest rates going up and they're big bond investors, I say, relax, relax. Do you have a long-term perspective? Because rising interest rates for bond investors and bond mutual funds, because remember the bond mutual funds dealing with millions of dollars, represents an opportunity because now you reinvest those interest payments, reinvest those principal repayments at a higher interest rate. So don't freak out about the fact that your bond mutual fund went down 2 or 3%. Realize that over the long term, this is a good thing for you if you have a long-term perspective. Of course, if you have a short-term perspective, then good luck. Slide number 34. Duration. This is something that we as individual investors usually don't have to worry about because we just don't have that much money to deal with bonds. This is something that the bond mutual fund managers and the pension fund managers, the life insurance companies, people who buy a lot of bonds have to worry about. This is a measure of a bond price's sensitivity to changes in interest rates and bond yields. It captures both the price and the reinvestment risk. And it's used to indicate how a bond will react in different interest rate environments. The duration of a bond changes as it approaches its maturity date and current interest rate changes and current interest rates change. So in general, the longer the bond's maturity, the longer its duration, hence the word duration, but the higher a bond's nominal rate and yield to maturity, the shorter its duration. The shorter its duration, the less potential price volatility and vice versa. Are we going to do any of the calculations? No. If you really want to learn them, you know, go ahead, but this is more for somebody or entities such as mutual funds, pension funds that have to worry about these things. And the same thing is true with immunization. I just love it. Like a virus? No, it's not a biological thing. Investors who have a specified time horizon can use what is called bond immunization to increase the probability of successfully achieving their desired goal. Keep the average duration of your bond investments equal to your time horizon, and then you would thus be more protected against interest rate-induced price swings. The problem with this is that it requires constant rebalancing of your bond portfolio since durations of bonds change as interest rates change and the bonds get closer to maturity. So who uses this? Again, pension fund managers, bond mutual fund managers, people with billions of dollars to invest. Those of us with $1,000 to buying a bond at treasurydirect.gov, we're not interested in this, okay? Slide 36. So let's boil it down to the three major bond investment strategies. The first strategy is the income strategy, which is what most people who are interested in bonds, especially very wealthy people, are interested in. What's it paying me for the interest income? The capital gains strategy is speculating that interest rates will fall. I don't like that word, speculating, do you? And then total return is purchasing bonds for the income and the possibility of capital gains. So obviously, which one of these is easiest to implement? Income strategy, which is the hardest capital gain strategy, because you're basically trying to guess the future direction of interest rates. And folks, there are people who are paid tremendous sums of money to incorrectly predict future interest rates. Can you imagine if they could actually do it correctly, how much they'd make? No, they can't do it. And then total return is a combination of both. And sometimes you'll see a bond fund that says total return bond fund. And so these people are, yes, we're buying the bonds for income, but we're also doing our best to buy bonds for capital gains, which is, you know, a lot riskier, but not as risky as stocks, folks. Slide number 37, bond laddering. Well, this is a diversification strategy that's great for people with tons of money. You buy bonds with staggering maturities. You purchase some bonds with short-term maturities, some with intermediate-term maturities, some with long-term maturities. Again, this is a very popular strategy with pension fund, bond, mutual fund managers, since they have considerable sums of money to invest. And what are the advantages and disadvantages of the strategy? Well, it's a diversification strategy, which, as we're going to see in when we get to Chapter 11 on diversification, and we've already pretty much seen it, diversification is a dual-edged sword. It gives us the diversification. It gives us the situation where, you know, we don't have our eggs in one basket, but when we do put our eggs in one basket, we have a potential to make a whole lot more money, but we have a potential to lose a lot more money. And so the same thing is true for bond laddering. So here's an example. You buy some bonds paying a little over 2%. Well, these are actually treasury bills, right? Treasuries. And then a few 2 to 3 years, 5 years, and then you work your way up the ladder. Now, personally, I would not be too excited about Treasury bond paying 3.3% for 30 years. It's going to go up. I don't know when, but it's going to go up. But other people say, no, you don't understand. We're in this for the we're in a low interest rate environment for the long term. But remember, just a couple of years ago, these Treasury bills were paying almost nothing. So the Fed is trying to push interest rates up, or not trying, they are pushing interest rates up, but the long-term bonds are starting to react. Here's the 20-year corporate paying a little over 5%. And boy, you know, if you get a corporate bond, a bond paying 6%, that's pretty darn good. So they're starting to normalize, but Treasury still, 10-year Treasury, a little over 3%. You know, there are people who are saying it's going to be 3.5% by the end of next year, 4% in 2 years. I don't know. But if interest rates are going up because the economy is improving, that's a great sign. Not only for bonds, but for stocks and for the economy as a whole. That's a great sign. So we should see interest rates rise as the demand for money is increased because there's more economic activity and things are hopping and popping, or people are happy and well-fed and well-clothed and well-sheltered and all have internet access. So let's hope for the best, huh? But if you do ladder your bonds and buy yourself some 10-year treasuries and 30-year treasuries, you're stuck with them, right? Because if interest rates rise, the price is going to go down. So either way, you're going to sell it. You're going to, you know, or if you hang on to it, you're still getting only 3%. I just can't get excited about that. Maybe you can, but no, I want to shoot for at least 5, 6, 7%. And that's what I think, but you know, just offhand, the next 10 years, I will be very, very happy if stocks return 5, 6%. All the dividend discount models, you've seen them, you've done them, are saying, you know, stocks are really overvalued. And so probably we're not going to get our typical 8, 9, 10%. We'll get 3, 5, 6, maybe. We'll see. But I'm not giving up on stocks because I think they're going to do better than bonds over this next 10-year period. And they typically do. Not always. Bonds clobbered stocks in the decade of the 2000s. But we'll see. We'll see. So I'm optimistic. Slide number 39. We're done. Yes, we're done bonds. And so, yes, bonds are boring. I apologize, but they're important. And now we're going to take a real quick little look at preferred stocks and convertible securities. Those are what we called back in Chapter 1 hybrid securities. They're a very small portion of the investment universe, but you really should know a tiny bit about them. And it turns out that the assignment for Chapter 18 is the easiest 5 points you'll get all semester long. And then we'll, excuse me, we'll wrap up, believe it or not, with asset allocation. We'll tie everything we've done together and the course will be done. No, it won't be. No, we won't be done. But we will have gone through the major investment alternatives for the vast majority of us. Then we'll start taking a look at some things that you should know about, if only to stay away from, and warn your friends and family to stay away from them. Derivatives, buying on margin, shorting stocks. And then we'll take a look at real estate and some of the other investment alternatives. So we're on the downhill side, dear students. We are so proud of you. Don't give up now. Stick with us. You are awesome. See you in our next little chapter on preferred stock and convertible securities, and then the all-important asset allocation.